Class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Iron Man Deez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. To start off, I am homesick with a bit of a sinus infection, and so I was skeptical. I wasn't really going to do this, but you know, you can only sleep so much. So I'm going to record this episode and get it out to you guys ASAP. Obviously, you can tell by the title that I'm going to be talking about something that we are all being impacted by. That is the coronavirus, COVID-19, as it was called. Now, I admit, before I get into the real topic of today's story, that when I heard about... Okay, I admit two things. First, I downplayed. I looked at the COVID-19 and said, you know, this just doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal compared to what was happening in 2018. You had a very, very bad flu season, which was taking the lives of young people. I mean, young people would get the flu and within a week would be dead. That was horrific. And so my original response to COVID-19 was, this is nothing. I mean, very few reported cases, very few reported deaths. I mean, this is nothing. And while I always err on the side of optimism, obviously this is something greater than I originally thought. I think it's something greater than a lot of people originally thought. Now, will it turn out to be a bigger problem than many of us think? Or will we maybe see 10,000 confirmed cases hit the summer and it's gone and maybe come back in the fall? We don't know. Or will it be one of them things where we're looking back from July and saying, my God, we only had 1,600 cases and now we're up to 2 million, 3 million with, you know, tens of thousands of people dead or dying. You know, I don't know. But, you know, it is obviously taking a toll on the society. The society did not need this. The society did not need it. I just had heard, and I'll get to the second thing that I'll admit in a moment, but I just had heard last week about something called Trump derangement syndrome, which was this kind of reaction to Trump that was illogical and emotionally driven, but also non-emotional. It was fluctuative, affecting a person who was typically very well balanced to a point where they were just very extremely hostile and very attack oriented and various other symptoms of a person going through extreme stress. Which the last 4 years, if we are very honest about, has been very stressful for the society. The unpredictability and fear associated with Trump has caused the society to be very, 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 very strictly depressed and anxious and stressed. And that's just, that's not a good omen. When you actually have to deal with a crisis that is national in scope, which it appears that COVID-19 is national in scope. Now, the second admission that I will say is, when I heard about the reaction of China's government to COVID-19, locking down whole cities, you know, testing people roadside, pulling them out their vehicles when they tested positive, and getting them to isolation immediately, my original question was, wait a minute, what do they know about this virus that we don't? Or what is it that they know about this virus that makes them so frightened? It was as if, and I thought this, I said, you know, it's as if they know it has the potential to be very deadly. And they're operating from that standpoint. Now, that might have just been naivety. Obviously, because of the type of virus that it is highly communicable. And it is not the type of thing that you want to mess around with. That said, I just found that strange. So, what does that have to do with anything? Not nothing. I just, you know, wanted to admit that I was one of them people who might have been called a conspiracy theorist at the beginning of all this. I am, you know, again, before I get into the topic, you know, I live in Central New York, and contrary to popular belief, Central New York is not Central New York City. There's actually a lot of country in New York. I don't live in the country anymore, but I live in a relatively, you know, middle, medium-sized city. I guess you can call it that. They actually do call it a city, but I think of Syracuse and Rochester and Buffalo as cities. This is significantly smaller than both of those places, but We are not, and when I say significantly small, let me just say the estimated population of the place where I live is a little bit over 25,000. We are not that affected by COVID-19 right now. Right now, I don't believe we have any people who have been infected here yet to our west, Rochester, New York, Monroe County. They have shut down. They have a couple of cases already reported there, including one which has scared the just bejesus out of the health department. The person was riding on a Greyhound bus from Rochester to Buffalo, and they weren't clear where he had come from, but they actually got off the bus at Rochester and then got on the bus and went to Buffalo, I guess. Transferred out if you haven't ever ridden the Greyhound. But, you know, to the south of us in New York City, there are hundreds of cases. And that doesn't even count what's going on in what's called downstate. It's above New York City. and what's going on Long Island. So, you know, stores are kind of stripped a little bit right now, and things are just, you know, things are crazy. I went out the other day to shop and was shocked by how crazy things were. But there's so much that we can extract from this, ladies and gentlemen, and I want us to think about what can we extract from this, because this is a lesson. There are so many lessons here. I am glad that I published the episode that I published before on what is the role of the government. I'm glad that I published that, because that is definitely a question that we need to be asking right now. What is the role of the government? What is the role of the government? At times like this, the role of the government becomes very, 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 very important, especially when you are in a country, which, let's be very, we have to be very honest about this, ladies and gentlemen. The United States of America is essentially supposed to be a unified federation of, or even, I guess, a Commonwealth Federation of states. Okay? I think one of the biggest problems that we have when we talk about the idea of government is we are not clear enough about what the United States is actually supposed to be. According to the preamble of the Constitution, Commonwealth is supposed to be part of the philosophical structure, the legislative structure of this society. To understand what the government is supposed to do for the society and for the country, we must have a clear picture of what the society is. And truthfully, again, we are supposed to be a federated Commonwealth. That's what we're supposed to be. The federal government, therefore, is supposed to play a role in setting the foundation for that Commonwealth, and when necessary, firmly establishing that Commonwealth so that the prosperity, the prodigy of the society can be continuous. It can continually be passed on for the generations. You see this in FDR. You see this in the New Deal. You also see this concept countered drastically in neoliberalism and neoconservatism, which are fundamentally against an idea of commonwealth that gives the federal government rights to really build the structures for commonwealth and common prosperity. When you have something such as a pandemic like this that pierces your society's borders, it enables you to see just how strong your commonality is and how shared the stresses of the pandemic are throughout the society. And yet, while all that is true and all that is important, it also shows you just how prepared your government is to shore up the society and to take care of the society when it is needed most. If we were to strip away all the high-minded concepts of government, the government's job is, you know, to really keep the society together during crises and to prepare for those crises when there are no crises, and to make sure that society is strong enough to weather those crises. That's pure and simple. Now, I think it's easy enough to finally say that because of what has been taking place within the government for the last 40 years, and we have to be very honest about this, from the moment that Reagan took the oath of office, we have had a nihilistic policy in place to destroy the government. And I'm going to be very fair, too, by the way, to Bill Clinton and to Obama, because both of them did not come into the federal government with a nihilist agenda. Obama had a little bit more nihilism when it came to education than, you know, I wanted, but he wasn't a nihilist. He did exactly what Bill Clinton did. They both built up areas of the bureaucracy which would benefit the public. They also built up some areas of the bureaucracy which would benefit the war machine, but, you know, I'm being fair here. They were hyperly against the nihilistic concept of destroying the government, destroying the government for the sake of benefiting the society. They found that just stupid, and so they didn't actualize it. Whatever else they may have done, not important at this moment. Not important at this moment. The fact that the two of them were each succeeded by a nihilist who was wholly committed to tearing apart the society, or excuse me, the government, to benefit the society, or so they would say, really does a disservice, it does a disservice to the work they did, but also it helps to cover up the work that they started and the work that they did. Reagan came into office wanting to just gut the federal government. He was very open about that. Bush 1 continued that to an extent. Bush 2 put that on steroids. And Trump absolutely has just taken a hatchet to the government, leaving it basically in tatters, except for areas which he thought was, you know, were important, or the people around him at least thought were important. Moreover, where he hasn't left it in tatters, he has placed corporate stooges there to leech off of the system, to privatize portions of the government, which this was something that Bush did too, that used to benefit society, but if in the hands of private interests, would make tons of money. This is the problem with having a realistic nihilist, someone who is about destruction in government. And we are now seeing the result of that. Moreover, and this aided in the confusion and the problems that have arisen with COVID-19. We have had an economic policy of the last 45 years of outsourcing, quote-unquote, jobs. Laying off jobs here and sending them to China, to Asia, to everywhere else. I heard a number the other day which stunned me, that about 90% of what Americans actually use comes from outside of the United States. So if there is a crackdown or, you know, and in these countries, the United States suddenly does without. If China really wanted to be cold about it, they could shut down the entire economic system of the United States without even batting an eye. Because so much of what we need comes from them. I hope you get what I'm saying here. I hope you get this. Because with nihilism tearing apart, and that's the wrong phrase, because nihilism is more of a philosophical construct. With nihilistic tendencies tearing apart the government and an economic policy which offshores jobs, we are in no position to deal with a crisis of this magnitude, especially if it gets as bad as some people are suggesting. What if, at the lowest end, we have 40 million people infected, direly infected, may I say? What if we have 40 million people that are direly infected, you know, 1% of that needing dramatic health care? That's 400,000 people. Again, I point to Joe Rogan again. You know, how is it that Joe Rogan, I mean, seriously, this is an indictment of corporatist media, and this is a complete repudiation of this idea that you need to have conglomerated media to make media better. How is it that Joe Rogan, who, you know, I don't want to really disparage the dude, because he's actually a pretty nice guy and all of that, but how the hell is it that it is him? How is it him that has the best interview? How is it him that has the best interview? And by the way, I've seen good interviews on RT, on Sky News, but I can't say the same thing about MSNBC or CNN. But the Joe Rogan one is the individual which he researched was talking about the amount of bed space that the United States has in its hospitals. And I think he said 1 million beds, I think. And significantly less ventilators. So, it, you know, 400,000 people who need ventilators doesn't sound like a lot. Even if, you know, 4% of that 40 million people are dire, need to get into a hospital bed, you know, so now you're talking, what, 1.6 million people who are going to need hospital beds. We don't have the capacity for that 1.6. Why? Because even though we have 1 million beds, as he pointed out, there's usually an 80% use rate. So that means you have 200,000 spare beds. 200,000. And with the ventilators, it's you know, significantly worse, because you just don't keep those around. So we're not in a position to deal with this. Moreover, and this goes back to the nihilist thing, the structures which would have been in place 25, 30 years ago to deal with this, because, you know, you still had institutional memory. And when by institutional memory, what I mean is you had people who still recalled the Great Depression working in government. Those structures have been stripped. Because, you know, after the USSR fell, you had psychopathic billionaires and millionaires saying, oh, it's the end of history. We don't need to be worried about stuff anymore because, hey, we're the greatest country on earth. So we don't need this anymore. This is just never going to happen. Or they were saying, you know, the economic cycle, the business cycle is over. It's a thing of the past. It's not actually a thing that we have to worry about anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, We are not prepared for this. And I don't mean to scare you. I don't want to scare you. Before you get worried, understand this. It's not about being scared. Okay, because I believe we're going to get through this. This really is a test. You know, I've said to you many times before that I'm about my metaphors. I'm about, you know, looking at something and saying, okay, there's a lesson here. There is a lesson here, ladies and gentlemen. The lesson is we're all in this together. I watched the debate between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, and Joe Biden is treating this like a one-off thing. Like if we could, you know, we just waive the co-payments, waive the pricing to get treated for this thing. And once when it goes away, we just return to normal when it comes to health care. No, ladies and gentlemen, this is a preview. This is a preview. And this is one of the primary reasons why I'm doing this episode is because this really is a preview. Lost amongst a lot of the discussion of global climate change is something kind of frightening. And I can't even remember. This was a couple years back. I was reading through some articles, and I came across this interesting article, which stated that scientists were wondering if the melting ice caps, or not the ice caps, I'm sorry, the melting Antarctic ice, the permafrost in Russia, and the gigantic Greenland ice sheets, if that was going to result in some ancient bacterium, virus, what have you, being released either into the ocean, into the air, bacterium and viruses which hadn't been around when there were humans here, and could those things actually infect us and cause pandemics? Just absolutely wreak havoc on the society. And I'm going to say, yeah, it'll probably happen. And I'm going to say, yeah, it'll probably happen because, again, I approach global warming very differently than a lot of other people do. I approach it from the standpoint of my indigenous brothers and sisters who have a lot more insight into the planet than so-called modern man. I approach global warming as a way of seeing the Earth fighting back against something which is making it sick. So, using diseases as sort of a, kind of what the body does when it dispatches its attack cells, its B cells, and what have you, those diseases attack the problem, which is us. Well, if we don't have the type of structures now to deal with what has been a pretty mild pandemic, what are we going to do if we have a disease? Let's say the Russian permafrost, okay? It's melting away. You have scientists going up there every single day or every month doing work. And one of them comes back, you know, goes through quarantine and what have you. But he picks up something that's so virulent that even with quarantine, it doesn't die. And he mistakenly transfers it to some paperwork. And that paperwork then is touched by an assistant. And the assistant leaves, never having been quarantined, and goes about their daily business, touching this, touching that, and this virus, bacterium, whatever, gets into the general population. Has a 3 to 4 week, 6 week incubation period before it turns drastically deadly for those who don't have a built-up immunity to it. It can mimic some internal biological structure, some bacterium that is very prominent throughout the body. So it blends in until it wants to do its work. And when it does its work, especially for a bacterium, then it is very destructive. And it passes very easily, very rapidly on surfaces where it can stay alive for 3 to 4 days, maybe even a week, maybe even longer. I mean, imagine a scenario where you have this thing which spreads to 100 million people in less than 6 months and 1 billion people in less than a year. It has a 5% mortality rate. In the United States, half of the population becomes sick within a year. You're talking about, let's just say, 170 million people in less than a year. 5% mortality rate? You're talking about 1.7 times 5? You're talking about over 10 million people there, dead. I'm not, again, trying to scare you, ladies and gentlemen. What I'm trying to put into your mind is if in a moment like that we are looking to local and state officials, there's a problem. The whole idea of having a federated commonwealth is to pool your financial resources together. Only time I think you should really use the phrase resource. But to pool your financial resources together in a way that is beneficial to all. So that your society is so robust that when a true dire emergency comes along, such as what I just described, or even what we're going through now, not only are you strong enough to get through it, but you have the capability to react and respond so quickly that it mitigates the problem, even if the problem is, or shouldn't it, and mitigate and maybe even minimizes the problem, even if the problem is ongoing. So yes, maybe you have something like what I described that takes a year, year and a half to really run its course. Doesn't die with the snow, doesn't die with the cold or anything like that. Maybe it does take a year and a half to go away. But what if instead of the 5% mortality rate, which is what it's doing all over the world, what if because we have a strong commonwealth-oriented central government, I'm not talking about an authoritarian government, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about a true democratic commonwealth government. What if the United States, because of economic changes that we've made, so most of our a lot of what we need as society is built here now. We have actual plans of dealing with this stuff that are implemented not only at the federal level, but also at the state and the local level. There's a coordination that happens, which Bush blew up, by the way. What if because we are prepared, now you go from a 5% mortality rate, which is devastating, to a 0.5%. Still devastating. But if you can look around the world and say, well, they're losing 5% and we're losing 0.5. Maybe even we're losing 1% or less. I think you'd say that was a success. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not about advocating authoritarian power. I am about advocating smart governance. I am about advocating commonwealth as an agenda. Because that's really what it comes down to. Everyone, you know, the code word today is populism. Everyone's, especially progressives who glom onto so many things are trying to use populism in a way that is beneficial to them. Populism is an extension and byproduct of democracy. You need it. But ultimately, populism isn't a governing philosophy per se. It is an electoral participation philosophy. The governing philosophy that we desperately need is commonwealthism. That's where we need to be going. It's time to get beyond conservatism and progressivism. The revolution which we need, which Bernie Sanders talked about in the debate recently, is this idea that there is no such thing as commonwealth. We need to have a commonwealth revolution, a revolution of values, as Dr. King said. We need that. We need it, pure and simple. And this is just telling us that we need it. The question is, will we heed it? Because if you think this is bad, and you know the idea that I just talked about with this with a bacterium that has a 5% mortality rate, blah blah blah. I mean, that's unlikely. That's very much unlikely. But if you think this is bad, wait till you see what's coming for climate change. And we aren't even trying to prepare for that yet. We're not even trying to prepare for that yet. This is exposing a lot. That's what I mean, ladies and gentlemen. This is exposing a lot. The question is, will we learn? Will we learn? I have my doubts. I have my doubts, because, again, during the debate, Joe Biden was pretty adamant that, look, we don't need to change anything. We just need to tweak some stuff for this crisis and then go back to business as usual. No. This society really needs to change. And I believe this is a precursor. This is something that is telling us just exactly how vulnerable and weak we are as a society. Either we will change, we will become more cooperative, we will become more commonwealth-oriented, we will become more communal, stop with this economically-driven nonsense. This idea that you need to make more, 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 more. That life is all about economics. Or we are going to descend into something very frightening, ladies and gentlemen. And I mean that. When I was walking through my local grocery store, and the panic that I was seeing with people, you know, I have never seen grocery store shelves that empty before in my life. But watching the panic as people were going through trying to get the stuff that they needed, watching as the local company, the local store, had started rationing certain items, like sweeteners, you know, watching that, it told me just how people were so atomized. They were so atomized that they knew that other people were going to look out stringently for themselves to the detriment of the community. That has to be remedied. The only way that we're going to get through the challenges that we will be facing in the coming 30, 40 years is we have to resurrect community, ladies and gentlemen, because no man is an island. Global warming is a problem which will either bring the world together or cause the world to fragment into disarray. The wealthy, they're telling you already where they want the world to go, which is to shatter into disarray. We can't do that, ladies and gentlemen. We have to rise above that. We need to build something greater. I believe that is actually what is promoting Bernie Sanders' campaign. I believe the whole idea of his not me, us concept really hits on this notion. This is what the generation is going to be about. The fact that other generations haven't been about it has led us to where we're at right now. I'm going to leave this here. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. It's going to be the hardest thing that I do to let this podcast go. Ladies and gentlemen, I am going to make this announcement again because I haven't on another episode that I got to release to you guys, but I'm going to make it here, that I have decided that I'm going to walk away from this podcast to build another podcast. I am doing it reluctantly, but it needs to be done. I don't know when my last episode will be for this one, but I will definitely keep you abreast of what's going on with that. Until then, please enjoy, you know, every episode that I produce, and you know, I will see you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.